saving lives in wartime Holland.
You would expect that a Jewish writer in hiding during the war would write a book about what it's like to be a Jew in hiding during the war. But in fact, Comedy in a Minor Key is at least as much about what it's like to be Dutch people hiding a Jew during the war.
That's Damien Searles, translator of the newly released English edition of Hans Kielsen's acclaimed novella, Comedy in a Minor Key. Kielsen was born in 1909, and his novella was first published in 1951.
There was a young Jewish guy hiding in Amsterdam. It was a young couple. This guy perfectly discomposed and became a danger for everybody. And then Hans Kielsen was sent out to have a look at him.
And that's Hans Kielsen's wife, Marita Kielsen-Lauritz, talking about a wartime incident that, it turned out during this interview, involved my own family. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the email preview of the New York Times book review landed in my inbox several months ago, I nearly fell off my chair. There was a review by Francine Prose of two novels by Hans Kielsen that have just been reissued by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. She wrote, "For busy, harried, or distractible readers who have the time and energy only to skim the opening paragraph of a review, I'll say this as quickly and clearly as possible. The Death of the Adversary and Comedy in a Minor Key are masterpieces, and Hans Kielsen is a genius." The centenarian author is married to a friend of mine, and the last time I was in the Netherlands, they graciously hosted me for several days in their home in a small town near Amsterdam. So I fired off an excited email to Marita, my friend, who told me that, yes, she and Hans were quite surprised when they were contacted by our first guest on today's program, translator Damien Searles, about Hans's novel Comedy in a Minor Key. Hans Kielsen came to the Netherlands in the 1930s. A German Jew, he saw the writing on the wall when Hitler came to power. When the Nazis invaded the Netherlands, Kielsen went underground. After the war, he published Comedy in a Minor Key in his native German, and in 1962, The Death of the Adversary was translated into English and published in the U.S. to rave reviews. Now they've both been reissued by FSG, with Comedy in a Minor Key brilliantly translated by Damien Searles. But before we begin our conversation with Searles, I should tell you how I made Hans Kielsen's acquaintance. I've mentioned before on this show that my father, Guido Tonnissen, was part of an underground group in Amsterdam during the war. It was led by a German emigre named Wolfgang Frommel. You'll hear his name mentioned later by Marita Kielsen. Frommel collected around him a group of young people, all devoted to classic European literature and art. Some of them were Jewish, and when the Nazis started making life really difficult for them, Frommel and his friends arranged for them to go underground. Now, my father and his first wife lived in the apartment above Frommel's in a 17th-century house on the Herentracht, one of Amsterdam's oldest canals. As hiding places began to be needed for the Jews in Frommel's group, the young couple were brought in to help. One young refugee came to live with them for the duration of the war. His name was Klaus Bach. And my father, a carpenter, built hiding places for the others. When the war ended, the group emerged from hiding, taking the name Castrum Peregrini, or Pilgrim's Castle. It's what they called their refuge during the war. Castrum Peregrini became a publishing house and a journal, and Marita Kielsen joined it soon after the war as a young woman. When I began researching my father's history, I met her, and she became a friend. She met Hans Kielsen in the course of her work, and they've been happily married for decades. Now, let's return to the story of Hans Kielsen, his novella Comedy in a Minor Key, and our conversation with the translator, Damien Searles. Damien Searles, I want to welcome you to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
I was thrilled to see in the New York Times book review that Hans Kielsen's book, Comedy in a Minor Key, had been published for the first time in English. What year was it written?
I've heard different things about whether it was also started during the war itself, along with his other novel that's just been republished, Death of the Adversary. He started Death of the Adversary while he was in hiding during World War II in Holland, and buried part of the manuscript underground, like literally in the soil, for safekeeping, and collected it again after the war. I've heard different things about whether comedy in a minor key was started then too, but it was published in 1947, 63 years ago, same year as Anne Frank's diary, as a matter of fact. So he wrote it and finished it quite quickly after World War II ended.
And it was a bestseller in the U.S. when it got translated. Is that right?
Death of the Adversary was a bestseller in the U.S. when it was translated. That was published in 1959 for the first time and did not do well in Germany, was quite hated in Israel, and did not make much of an impression anywhere except in the U.S., where it was a Time magazine book of the year in 1962 and a brief bestseller. But then completely fell off the radar. 3 years ago, nobody had heard of it. It wasn't in libraries. There was no information about it online, nothing.
And what happened to Comedy in a Minor Key?
Comedy in a Minor Key was never translated. It was published, as I say, in 1947 by a German language publisher for books in exile called Corrido. They stayed active during the war itself and managed to have some kind of cover organization that let them stay in business, and they published a lot of German language stuff in exile. So Comedy came out in 1947 in that press. It didn't come out with Fischer, his German publisher, until 1988, and it was just never translated. I don't think it's been translated into Dutch yet, although now it's going to be next year. And never translated into English. I found the copy of the German book in a bargain bin in Austria 3 years ago, completely by accident.
This is an amazing story. Well, first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself. Why were you in Austria? What you were looking for then, and how this book, so excited you, came into your hands?
Well, I'm a writer and a translator. I mostly translate from German, although I also do translate from a few other European languages. And my wife and I were spending a year in a few various places in Europe. We were in Klagenfurt, Austria, because in the past I've translated books by and also about a very, very great Austrian writer named Ingeborg Bachmann, who is from Klagenfurt. And so I had a connection there, and I was in a sort of writer's studio for a couple months in 2007. And this was literally a box, a bargain bin, outside a Yugoslavian specialty bookstore. Klagenfurt is near the border of now Slovenia. So I was flipping through it, and in fact, there's a movie called Romance in a Minor Key that's mentioned in Ingeborg Bachmann's wonderful, wonderful autobiographical story, Youth in an Austrian Town, which is about Klagenfurt. So I saw Comedy in a Minor Key and was confused and thought it was Romance in a Minor Key. So that's why I picked it up out of the bin and quickly realized that this was not the book that the Bachmann movie was about. But it looked interesting, and so I bought it for a euro or whatever it was, and that was how I found it.
And what did you think about it as you read it?
It was a different side of things about World War II and about the Holocaust, and I certainly did not expect that I would be running into new angles on that. There have been so many books and movies and histories, and you know, I'm not a specialist on that per se, but I had certainly read my share of them and seen my share of movies. And this was something different because it didn't end in the concentration camp. So the story of Comedy in a Minor Key, I'll try not to give away too much of the plot because it's a very exciting, tightly structured, plotted book. But the setup is that it takes place in World War II in Holland, and an ordinary young Dutch couple, Wim and Marie, have decided to take a Jewish man into their house and hide him, let him go underground, let him go into hiding in their house. during the war. And you find out right at the beginning of the book that this man, who's known as Nico, short for Nicodemus, has died of natural causes in their house. And so now what are they going to do with the body? Because they still can't get caught posthumously, but now, of course, they can't keep the body in the house. So what are they going to do? And the thing about that structure, where it's a comedy, where he doesn't get deported, is that it lets Kyleson really show in flashback. Most of the book is flashback about the year or so when Nico was in hiding in their house. And you really get to see what it was like, how Vim is not a political person, but he sort of gets convinced to take this guy in, how Marie is just this Dutch housekeeper and has this stranger in her house for a year and meanwhile can't wash the pots properly because you can't get good sponges during the war. And it's really this amazing insight into what life was really like, not just for Nico, but also for the Dutch people who were hiding him. And because it's not overshadowed by, in the end, he got shipped off to Auschwitz, you get to really experience it in a way that I hadn't ever seen before.
We're speaking with translator Damon Searles. The book he's translated is Comedy in a Minor Key by Hans Kyleson. Kyleson lives still at the age of 100 in the Netherlands and was born in Germany in 1909. Hans Kyleson himself also went into hiding during the war. Tell us about that, and what did he end up doing?
Well, Hans Kyleson is currently 100 years old and going strong. He was born in the eastern part of Germany in 1909 and trained as a doctor but wasn't allowed to practice medicine. He published his first novel that was quickly banned because he's Jewish, and it was 1934. And so he left. He was convinced by the Catholic woman he wasn't allowed to marry, but who he was partner with, to leave Germany. And he went to Holland in 1936, which, of course, was not ultimately far enough away from Nazi Germany. So he spent the war years in Holland. He was in hiding in Delft. And by that point, he and the woman had a daughter who he almost never saw during the war because the daughter lived with her mother. And he was in hiding in a Dutch couple's house. He dedicates Comedy in a Minor Key to the couple. And after about a month where they were keeping an eye on him to see if he was reliable, they asked if he wanted to help out in the resistance. So what he actually did during the war was he was given basically the world's best fake ID that the Amsterdam police had helped put together. So as a native Dutch doctor van den Linden, he traveled around to other houses where children or teenagers were in hiding away from their parents. And he basically gave them psychological counseling. If they were having behavior problems or having other difficulties with their foster parents, he would be their psychiatrist and counselor and then go back to Delft and go back into hiding in the house he was staying in himself. It's quite an amazing story.
What's also amazing is that in some way this wartime fiction became a post-war fact. He became a psychiatrist. His dissertation is the definitive work on war orphans, on the psychology of war orphans.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a cliche to mention Chekhov whenever you're talking about a writer who's also a doctor, but it's pretty hard to avoid it in Carlson's case because the fiction is so empathetic and able to get inside the heads of people in very different positions from him. You would expect that a Jewish writer in hiding during the war would write a book about what it's like to be a Jew in hiding during the war. But in fact, Comedy in a Minor Key is at least as much about what it's like to be Dutch people hiding a Jew during the war. And then Death of the Adversary is an even more startling leap in a way because it's about the sort of symbiosis between the persecutor and the persecuted, between the Jews and Hitler or the Nazis in general, and about the ways in which they share certain psychological bonds with each other. that are quite powerful.
When I stayed with Hans and Marita Kielsen in 2004, I noticed Kielsen's dissertation about the traumatic effects of the war on Jewish children. I began to read it and was impressed by its compassion and humanity.
It really is amazing. And the fact that he is directing his empathetic and compassionate gaze on the Dutch people who were not persecuted, or in fact, even on the Nazis, the persecutors themselves, makes it that much more remarkable. I've looked at his dissertation. It has been translated into English and is, you know, available in some university libraries. It's called Sequential Traumatization, which is a bit of an off-putting title to non-specialists in psychology. And the book itself is pretty technical and dry, except for the fact that he has dozens of little case studies in there. So the reason it's called Sequential Traumatization is that he really pioneered the idea that trauma isn't just a one-time traumatic event that you suffer from afterwards. It can be a narrative. It can be a story. It can be a series of events that build on each other and sort of create a track that someone's life is going to follow or not follow from there on out. It's a sequence. And, of course, once you've heard that, it makes sense, because if you have an abusive parent, or if you are in hiding from the Nazis and first, you know, this person leaves your life and then you go into hiding and then you have these problems with your foster parents and then you hear the news about this or that, it's a whole sequence of things. So what his book is about is how to understand traumatization as a story, basically. And so he gives case studies of dozens of children who, say, lost their parents or went into hiding at different ages, and how it makes a difference whether they experienced it as a 4-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old. And the stories themselves are these very moving little vignettes. Of course, they're non-fictional. They're case studies for his psychiatry book. But at the same time, they are these very moving and striking little stories of the Dutch children. So after the war, for decades, he worked with them and treated them and interviewed them. He met with, I've heard the number as 204 of the Dutch Jewish survivors of World War II. Barely 2,000 Dutch Jewish children survived. The rest were killed. And he met with over 200 of them. And that was the basis of this, of his dissertation, his psychology book.
I'm talking with Damien Searles. He's translated Hans Kielsen's novella, Comedy in a Minor Key, into English, and it's just been published by FSG, along with Kielsen's novel, The Death of the Adversary. Kielsen, a German Jew in wartime Holland, first went underground and then joined the resistance. Now, the portrayal, on the one hand, the irony, the comedy even, of the portrayal of the psychology of these rescuers is really striking, because on the one hand, it's a very penetrating insights that he makes into their character, but insights that are made with also here a deep empathy. Describe, for example, Marie, what her feelings are about Nico and how they change after he's died, what she finds about herself.
Well, Marie is a young woman. It's never quite said exactly, but I picture her as being around 24 or 25 years old and has been married a couple years and is a good Dutch housewife. She does laundry and cooks and keeps the house in order while her husband goes to work. And if you've ever seen Dutch still life paintings or spent time in Holland yourself, you can have a picture in your mind of this domestically centered woman. What's more domestic than a Dutch housewife in a Dutch still life painting? That's what Marie starts from. And so she is a bit nervous about having this stranger come into her house and live there for a year in the upstairs room. And neither she nor her husband really know what that involves. At first, they don't know who they can tell and who they can't tell, and they sort of get used to it over time. But here she is with this stranger living in her house and coming downstairs for meals and spending most of the time kind of locked away up in his room. And then as the year goes on that he spends there, of course they, on the one hand, become closer and get to know each other a bit better, and the whole situation normalizes itself a bit. But on the other hand, this isn't the kind of book where any of the characters are these sort of cartoon cutouts of heroic resistance fighters. You know, it's still always a bit awkward having this guy in the house. They never really understand each other. Even though Carlson is so empathetic and able to understand, he doesn't give that quality to all of his characters. So they don't really know what Judaism is about. At one point she asks him, you know, why didn't you just convert? Why do you let yourself be hunted like this? I mean, she can't really see the relationships between Nazis and Jews. She just hasn't thought about it. She's just this ordinary person living her life. And then it's only after he dies that she, in a way, starts to really understand him. There are two important things that happen. One is that she finds a packet of expensive tobacco that he's kept hidden from them. Of course, you can't get tobacco during the war. You can, if you're lucky, only get the really cheap, disgusting stuff. And so at first, she's a little shocked that he had been so ungrateful and he'd kept this secret from them. And, you know, her husband would have loved a good cigarette like this. And how could he do this to them? She has this very natural reaction of resenting him. And then the light kind of dawns for her and she realizes, you know, he needed to have something of his own that wasn't shared, that was private, that was his secret, that wasn't entirely due to this Dutch couple taking them in. Because how can you live like that if you owe everything to these other people?
So she remembers this about him. It's a very poignant moment. And I also was struck by the fact that she imagines him sitting in his terror, in the depression. You know, here he's confined in this room. He cannot go out. In fact, there is a point in which he does go out. She has left some soup to burn. She forgot about it. He goes into the kitchen to shut it off because he smelled the burning. And just at that moment, somebody comes to the door, the milkman, or I believe it is the milkman who comes to the door. And, you know, they're in a quandary. He's in the kitchen. And what is he going to do? And the whole sense of the fraught danger of it and his terrible sense of guilt that he had put them all at such risk when he was here just trying to do something just to really help them.
Right. That's one of the great scenes where, so it's actually some milk she leaves burning and then the fish seller shows up, and fish is a sort of rare deal at this point. And so they don't want to send him away because then he won't come back. So not only does he come to the door, but Marie has to invite him in. And he's stuck downstairs in the kitchen, so what are they going to do? And the scene after that is really wonderful because they're all trying to reestablish their dignity. On the one hand, he does, as you say, feel terrible and feels guilty. But, you know, he also wasn't doing anything that crazy, and she did leave the milk to burn. And so she, on the other hand, feels like he's criticizing her when he's the one who put them all in danger. It's this very complicated scene. In general, with Nico, although I've been emphasizing how much Hans Carlsen talks about the Dutch couple, of course you do get a lot of great passages about Nico's sense of conflict and dependence, and he feels grateful, but on the other hand, you can't feel so grateful to someone without restoring a little bit of your own dignity in one way or another, whether it's by keeping the cigarettes as a secret or something else. I think I was thinking about this recently, that, you know, Death of the Adversary is a very dark book where there are villains and where there's evil. And so comedy in a minor key, in contrast, you know, why is it called comedy? In a way, it's a comedy because it does work out for everybody as best as could in the situation. And what that means, especially for Nico, is that all the characters keep their dignity. This is such a book about when you're in a difficult situation or when you're in an impossible situation or horrible things are happening, what kind of arrangements do you make with yourself or with other people in order to, you know, be able to keep going? And for Wim, the Dutch husband, taking in this Jewish refugee is part of what lets him continue to feel good about himself. And for Nico, keeping these cigarettes secret are part of what lets him carry on. And for Marie, there's so many examples of, at first, not really fully understanding what Nico's going through. And then after Nico has died, she does start to understand more and more. And as you say, kind of imagine herself in his shoes. After he dies, there's this wonderful passage where it talks about how disappointed Marie is because it's been so difficult keeping him here. And so to keep them going, they've had this little daydream about the war being over and the three of them strolling out of their house arm in arm and all the neighbors looking and seeing that they've had this man in hiding the whole time. Everyone would recognize from his Jewish face and from his pale skin that he's been in hiding. And they would get to stroll proudly down the street and have a feeling that they personally had, in their small way, won the war. And, of course, now this will never happen because he's died of pneumonia. This is the passage that Francine Prose quotes as this wonderful example of humor and complexity and this sort of sad but ultimately powerful insight that he has into the fact that, you know, everyone has mixed motives for everything.
I wanted to make an observation about something. Personally, for me, I had my own little revelation in some way like Marie did while reading this book. As I told you before we began this interview, my father had sheltered a young man during the war in his apartment for 3 years, from 42 to 45. And there was a certain point at which the Gestapo found out about the apartment. My father had to leave, which is why he ended up in the United States. Ultimately, he had to flee occupied Holland. And everybody had to go someplace else, including this young man. And there's a description in that I got from other people that this young man had been terrified. You know, he was just one of these people who could not mask his terror to be outside. I mean, he was only 14 when he actually was taken in, so he was quite young. And people were worried about him because they felt that, you know, he looked very Jewish and he looked very scared, and so he was a kind of liability. And the sense that I got as people talked about him was, you know, it wasn't very nice in a way, the way they were talking about it, as if there was something wrong with him to be so terrified. And in Hans Kielsen's book, Comedy in a Minor Key, which you, Damien Searles, has so marvelously translated, I finally got the sense of what it must have been like for this young man. And I really got the sense of compassion for him that I had not felt before because I hadn't heard it from others.
That's a great story. And I've heard similar reactions to both of these novels of Hans Kielsen, both the one I found and translated and then the one that was reissued, Death of the Adversary. People, myself included, you know, have heard all these things before and you know the facts of these kinds of stories, but Kielsen is able to really make you feel what it's like on the inside, and not in an incredibly dramatic, beat-you-over-the-head kind of way, but in the way that feels like what life is really like, where, you know, things are complicated and your feelings don't come with labels that tell you what it is you're feeling. There's all these different emotions and ideas and complicated reactions to things that go on in your mind. But underneath that is your core as a human being who is, you know, feeling these things and responding to these things and just reacting as best you can, whether you're in hiding, whether you're someone who's sheltering someone, whether you're someone who's decided not to, whether you're a Nazi, whatever you are, you're still making your way through this jungle of feelings and thoughts about things. And something about Kielsen's writing is able to not tell you about that, but just put you there.
Damien Searles. We'll talk more after a break. Stay tuned. Back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Damien Searles about his translation into English of Hans Kielsen's novella, Comedy in a Minor Key. Written soon after World War II, it's about how a young Dutch couple react when the Jewish refugee they're hiding from the Nazis dies a natural death in the midst of the war. Kielsen himself went into hiding during the war, then joined the resistance. Did you have any challenges with this translation? I mean, you as a translator of German, what were some of the things that you worked with in making translations, the translation of this book?
The thing about the style of this book is that it has this very dry, abbreviated, sort of hard-boiled tone to it in a lot of ways. There are very short sentences. There are a lot of sort of partial sentences that end with a dash or that sort of trail off with three periods. And the other thing is that one way Kielsen gets you so into the experiences that he's describing is that he cuts back and forth between different scenes or different points of view or different times without really setting it up. So, in other words, he'll be talking about a conversation that the Dutch couple are having with each other, and then suddenly he'll be giving a conversation that the Dutch couple had with Nico a year earlier. And there won't be a phrase up front saying, a year ago what they were saying was, he'll just go ahead and give it. So it sounds more confusing than it is. He actually keeps you very aware of what's going on, but you do have to pay a certain amount of attention, and at the same time, you sort of feel yourself moving back and forth between memories and experiences the way it happens in real life. So the main thing that I had to do was make sure that it was going to be as clear to the English reader as it is to the German reader without over-explaining or oversimplifying what's going on. At one point, a copy editor wanted to put an extra line space or three asterisks to indicate every place in the book where the time frame shifted back and forth. And I had to say, no, you know, we can't do that. It's essential to how this book works that those transitions are seamless.
And you were really right about that. The first time it happened, I had to do like a little check, what's going on here? And then I realized it, and from then on, it was absolutely no trouble at all. It really did add, in fact, to the sense of the mood of the book, because, as you say, you know, in real life, we live in the past and the present all the time.
And then the other way he does that is sometimes he'll say he said or he thought, and it won't always be immediately obvious whether it's Vim or Nico or the doctor or some other person. And in a way, that's disorienting, but in another way, you need that moment of disorientation in order to get totally sucked in to the psychological experience of the different characters. You need to be disoriented out of your own psychology in order to really inhabit someone else's. It seems to me that that's sort of how this book works. So the translation was mostly a matter of making sure I didn't add anything, that even if I was tempted to explain something or clarify something, how to keep it clear without adding any extra clarification was the issue with this book. But it's very smoothly and clearly and cleanly written. It's not at all a kind of difficult book. Hans Carlsen has never been, you know, a modernist. He's never been doing James Joyce stuff or David Foster Wallace stuff. He's very classical. So it's a very kind of pure, clean style. And the challenge of translating it is just to keep it that clean.
And the book is Comedy in a Minor Key. I've been talking with a translator, and again, I will say it is a wonderful translation. The book is by Hans Carlsen, who is 100 years old and lives in Holland. Thanks so much, Damien Searles, for talking to us today on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much.
Damien Searles is an award-winning translator of writers including Rilke, Proust, Ingeborg Bachmann, and Robert Walser. Next up, we talk with Hans Carlsen's wife and my friend, Marita Carlsen. As I said at the top of the hour, I met Marita Carlsen while I was in the Netherlands researching my father's wartime history. I didn't know my father, Guido Tennyson, very well. My mother and I left him when I was 4 years old. But after he died, I decided to find out more, and that led me to make Marita's acquaintance. While she never knew my father, she became a post-war member of the organization he'd been part of, Castrum Peregrini. Since Hans Carlsen doesn't speak English very well, I thought it would be wonderful to have Marita talk about him and his work instead. And much to my surprise, she ended up giving me an other piece to the puzzle of my father as well. Well, Marita Carlsen Lauritz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Damien Searles, who has translated Hans's book, and I wanted to ask you, just to fill us in a little bit, tell us a little bit about Hans's work during the war.
Hans, my husband, was hiding himself in Delft. The comedy in a minor key, dedicated to Leo and Suus, and that was a couple where he was hiding. Their name was Leo and Suus Reinsma. Of course, his situation of hiding was not as dramatic as a novella, of course. Leo Reinsma was involved in a group called, a resistance group called Freie Groepen Amsterdam. And after he knew Hans a little bit better, then they asked him if he would work for them as a troubleshooter in difficult hiding situations.
And what did that mean?
For instance, there was a young Jewish guy hiding in Amsterdam with a young couple. This guy, year of 17, I think, he perfectly discomposed and became a danger for everybody and for his hosts also, of course. So the resistance thought about killing this guy. And then Hans Carlsen was sent out to have a look at him, and he could manage to have him placed at an Amsterdam hospital. And so this guy survived the war.
Wow, so the resistance actually would have to
killed him otherwise, because he did very crazy things, running through the street and calling Heil Hitler and things like that. And so they had to do something, hiding the hosts were in great danger by him.
Now, did he have any training in psychology at all before he started to do this work?
No, but he had studied medicine in Berlin, and he has an education as a teacher, sports teacher also. So he had some pedagogical background also. And when he came to the Netherlands, he coached a lot of child in problems and child with problems at school and things like that. But he has no psychiatric background at that time. That was after the war, what he did here in the Netherlands.
So he was a kind of troubleshooter on the one hand, but he also did some counseling for children who were in hiding during the war. Is that true as well?
Troubleshooting period, I think, was during the war. When he was sent by the resistance group, Freie Group in Amsterdam, to difficult situations, that was during the occupation.
Okay, so he wasn't...
That was for children in a difficult hiding situation. There were children here in the Netherlands who changed the hiding place about 20 times during 2 years or so, something like this. That's not so simple for the children and not for the hosts, of course.
Here's where I found out that Kyleson's story and my father's story intersected during the war. Do you remember the young man who was mentally disturbed, Marita Kyleson mentioned earlier? Hans Kyleson had found a place for him in a mental hospital when his behavior put him and his hiders at risk. But what she didn't say was that eventually he came under suspicion as a Jew in that hospital and had to go into hiding again. That's when Wolfgang Frommel became involved. Now, this reminds me of a case in the Castrum Peregrini, which you were associated with after the war. And it was, of course, an underground group during the war.
They were related to the same Freie Group in Amsterdam.
Oh.
Yes.
That I never knew.
Oh.
My goodness.
Yes.
Now, there was a case there where there was a young Jewish boy.
Oh, it's the same boy.
It was the boy that you just spoke
about? It's the same boy, because he was picked up at that hospital by Frommel from the Castrum Peregrini.
Wolfgang Frommel.
Wolfgang Frommel. And taken into the house
on the
Herengracht.
That's where my father was.
And all the difficulties there with this guy.
Well, I had read...
It's just the same guy. And if you read the book once more, then you will see there is a mentioned psychiatrist. And that's just...
That's Hans
Kyleson.
Oh, my goodness. So here, this was the group that my father was in, and this is the house that my father lived in.
Yeah.
And the book we're talking about is the book that was written after the war by the man that my father took into his apartment, that was Klaus Bock.
Yes.
And Klaus Bock talks about, he calls him, I believe, Toby in the book. Is that correct?
Yes, Tori,
that's
yes,
right.
Yes, Tori.
And he survived the war, and
he survived the war, and he was he had, I think, a little bookshop. I never met him, and afterwards I understood that he died in, I think, 1970 somewhat.
That's right.
By suicide.
So, wow, this is remarkable. Now, you have added a piece to the puzzle that I'm following here. This is so exciting. And Hans was the psychiatrist.
Yes.
Wow. And so now tell us
Since he was not then, really,
And so did he know after when the war was over, did he know right then that he wanted to become a psychiatrist, or was this something that developed
I
over?
I think that began much earlier. When he was 17 of 16, he won a little prize from a competition of books. And then he got some money, and he has to buy books. So he bought Sigmund Freud Vorlesungen über die Psychoanalyse, a little edition he has taken with him from Berlin, and he has it up to this day. And so there was some interest much earlier than after the war. And after the war, when he completed his medical study in the Netherlands, he specialized in neurology and psychiatry, and he got an education as a psychoanalyst.
And so I understand that he has written really the definitive study of the war trauma of war orphans in the Netherlands. Is that right?
Yes, he began to write this, I think, in the 60s, and he completed it in the 70s, and he got his PhD in 1979, when he was nearly 70 years old. After the war, he was asked to help Jewish war orphans to coach them. There was about 2,000 children in the Netherlands whose parents has died, and who the children survived mostly in hiding. Some of them came back from concentration camps. And there he worked for years and years. And in the 60s, he began to do research on what he has done this, and he published the story in 1979. And it was translated in English and in French.
We're talking with Marita Kielsen Lauritz, wife of Hans Kielsen. He, at the age of 100, is seeing his decades-old novels of World War II being reissued in English in the U.S. Until recently, he practiced as a psychotherapist in Holland, and we're talking about his definitive study of Jewish war orphans. I asked Marita if she had a story about one of the children he knew during the war.
There is a very curious story. Last year, we got in contact to the neighbors of the family where he was in hiding. And there were three brothers and a girl. And the girl was the youngest of them, and the oldest boy was, I think, about 15 then. And he remembered Hans Kielsen coming from the house from the neighbors. There was a secret door in the attic where he could, in dangerous situations, go from one house to the other. After, so that was a hiding place. And then he talked to this boy and about books and about poems and about a lot of things. And the youngest one of the children, the girl, wrote an email to me last year when her brothers had contacted and visited us and told her about this. And she said, oh, for me it was just very, very, I was very anxious about this guy coming downstairs from a secret door upstairs on the attic, playing music with my mother and going away. And but now I understand, and the whole story for me is now complete. So you understand, she was just was a sort of trauma for this child, not in hiding, but just a child of a family hiding others.
So she was the child of a family who was hiding
others.
Others, and Hans came in and would play music with her before going upstairs.
She was just very anxious of the hiding people, so that's something to have in mind also.
That's right, that the children who were not hiding were also, of course, traumatized by the war.
Of course, because there was so much secret whispering about things, not talking about things, so that must be very traumatizing for just the children of the host.
Now, let me understand, was this the home that Hans himself was hiding in, or he was visiting people?
The neighbors. So it was two houses, and there was a door in the attic from one house to the other. And both had people hiding in there, and he was hiding by the Rheinsmaß, and he came down in the house of the neighbors sometimes when it was safe.
Hans Kielsen has become a celebrity in the Netherlands because of all the praise he's garnered in the U.S. The Death of the Adversary has been issued in Dutch, and a Dutch edition of Comedy in a Minor Key is in the works. I asked Marita Kielsen how Hans and she are taking all this attention decades after his books were written.
It's just very nice what happens now. But Hans is just the same person. His books are just the same books as before. Don't you do you realize it? And it's very nice, everything, and we enjoy it very much. And by the way, we are very, very, very grateful to Damien and everything he did for us. And that's perhaps here in the Netherlands, somebody is guessing from how is his story, who is this possible, and maybe the published house in the United States has done this and has done that and has sought this. And Damien has found his book. He has decided to translate it. He liked it. So he was the one who did it, all of it. And as far as I can see, the publishing house in the United States was just as surprised as we was.
I think they were. And they're all quite happy.
Yes. Oh, everybody is happy. Here, the second print is sold out in the Netherlands of the Dutch translation of the In de Band van de Tegenstander. And they're printing the shirt at the moment.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, they told me this morning that they sold 1,000 books in one day, that's a lot for the Netherlands.
Well, I congratulate Hans through
you
and you too, Marita. This has just been so wonderful for me as well, because, you know, I get to talk to you about this, and this has just been a wonderful interview. Thank you.
So thank you so much. And I hope to stay in contact.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Take care, Marita, and give a very strong congratulations and hug to Hans for me.
Thank you.
Take care. Marita Kielsen. You can find an excerpt from Klaus Bach's story of Tori Goldstern, the young mentally disturbed man rescued by Hans Kielsen, at writersvoice.net. Next week, we'll talk with the great civil rights leader Bob Moses about his campaign for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing a quality education for all. He also makes a connection between civil rights and educational rights. And to set the frame, we talk with historical journalist Bruce Watson about his terrific new book, Freedom Summer, The Savage Season That Made Mississippi Burn and Made America a Democracy. Here's an excerpt where Bruce Watson talks about Bob Moses.
Freedom Summer is very controversial among SNCCs, among the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, because their reason for being and their whole philosophy was very different from that of Martin Luther King. They felt that leadership had to come from the ground up. And so SNCCs had spent a lot of time in Mississippi, in the Delta, and elsewhere, working with local blacks and trying to empower them and get them to take responsibility and to take leadership roles. But it wasn't working. There was so much stonewalling. There was so much violent backlash. And there was very little publicity coming out of Mississippi. The rest of America just sort of regarded as Mississippi as beyond the pale. It was just seen as the most reactionary state where no progress is going to be made. So finally, Bob Moses and others of SNCC decided we've got to do something different. We've got to bring America into Mississippi. So the idea was to bring 700 or more college students in that summer to register voters, to teach in freedom schools, to staff freedom houses, and work with local black community. But it was very controversial, as I say, because many people thought that would pull the rug out from under the locals, that if all these highly qualified and articulate white folks came down, they would take the initiative away. And to a certain extent, that did happen. And yet it also, once they decided to go ahead with it, it took on a momentum of its own and really began to change Mississippi.
You mentioned Bob Moses. In many ways, he was the driving force behind it, although he was not alone. Tell us a little bit about him. He was looked upon as kind of almost a saint.
Of course, it didn't hurt having a name like Moses, and sometimes you wonder about prophecy and how these things happen. But many people in the movement, especially the more religious people like Fannie Lou Hamer, thought his name was no coincidence. They thought he'd been sent. You know, they didn't think, of course, he was literally a saint. But he did have a very saintly presence about him. He had grown up in Harlem, the son of a janitor. His intelligence had earned him scholarships to college and eventually to Harvard for a master's program. But he had to leave that to care for his father. And he was teaching math in a New York prep school when the sit-ins happened in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. And he looked at those photos and he really saw a whole new attitude in the South. And he felt like he had to take part in it. And he went South and he went to Mississippi, unlike Martin Luther King and others. And he went alone. He would walk up to, in the deepest, most rural part of Mississippi, walk around the communities talking to black folks and talking about the right to vote. Of course, the word got out very quickly. He was beaten, he was shot at, and he simply refused to be cowed, refused to be intimidated. And he developed this icy calm about him. He would, even when blood was streaming down his forehead, he would lead blacks into the courthouse and say, "We're here to register to vote." And how he got out alive, I do not know.
That's next week. Bob Moses and Bruce Watson. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.